lovers, welcome to Get Real, a podcast hosted by the National Animal Interest Alliance, through which we'll have deeply honest conversations about animal research so we can learn together and make compassionate choices about our medical future together. Welcome to episode 29 of Get Real. I'm Dr. Cindy Buckmaster, your host for Get Real. And today we're going to talk about something that most of us never think about. Biomedical research with animals isn't only necessary for improving human and animal lives. It's also critical for protecting our food supply and our economy. Dr. Maggie Behnke, attending veterinarian for the USDA National Bio and Agro Defense Facility, joins us today to lay out the facts on Get Real. Hey, animal lovers. Joining us today is Dr. Maggie Behnke, the attending veterinarian at the USDA National Bio and Agro Defense Facility. Dr. Behnke, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Well, it's going to be a really interesting conversation. Before we get into this cool place that I just mentioned, I think maybe a little historical context is in order for our listeners. I think most have heard about the Plum Island Animal Disease Center, but most of us have no idea what was studied there or why, right? We just kind of know that whatever it was dangerous and scary, right? Because they put this center in the middle of a barrier island, right? So maybe before we get into the cool facility you're at now, you can give us a little background about what was actually studied at the Plum Island Animal Disease Center and why that even matters to us in the United States and the rest of the world.
Yeah, you can't talk about the National Bio and Agro Defense Facility, or NBAF as we call it, without first talking about Plum Island Animal Disease Center. So Plum Island is in New York. It is on an island. It's a BSL-3 ag facility and diagnostic lab owned and operated recently by Department of Homeland Security. That building and the facilities there at Plum Island are 68 years old. So a while back, the United States government recognized that the important capabilities that Plum Island has need to be preserved, but the building itself was really aging out. So that is when the concept of NBEF came about.
So when you say BSL-3, there are people listening that don't know what that means. Maybe you can talk about the biocontainment levels and the level of danger that escalates as those numbers escalate.
When we talk about working with pathogens, there is kind of a hierarchy of how those pathogens could affect humans or animals. They become more risky as you go up the scale. So BSL-1 pathogen is not much of a pathogen. It would be things that we come into contact every day. BSL-2 pathogens become a little bit more risky for folks that might be immunocompromised or have issues. They could make those folks sick, but there's countermeasures and treatments for those diseases. When you get to BSL-3, the diseases are those that could be spread by the respiratory route in aerosols and may or may not have easily preventable vaccines or things available. And then BSL-4 pathogens are the most dangerous. And those are the ones that are like Ebola that do not have a good treatment.
Right. So diseases that were at the BSL-3 level are currently being studied at the Plum Island facility, like human diseases, animal diseases. What are they actually doing at Plum Island? And what's the relevance for us?
The mission of Plum Island is to really protect our food supply. Plum Island has been focused on diseases of livestock primarily. They have been studying three primary diseases, foot and mouth disease, which is not the same as hand, foot, and mouth disease. A lot of people think that. That's a human disease of childhood for the most part, but this is foot and mouth disease of livestock. They also study classical swine fever and African swine fever. And those are the three major pathogens where they conduct research and are looking to develop vaccines and countermeasures for those pathogens. The other really important thing about Plum Island is that there is a diagnostic lab there where any samples in the United States that are suspicious for one of these foreign animal diseases occurs, Plum Island is the lab that gets sent out to. So whether it occurs in California or it occurs right there in New York, those samples have to be transported all the way to Plum Island to be verified that they are not foot and mouth disease or any of these other dangerous pathogens that we don't have currently in the United States.
The livestock in the U.S. are not affected by these diseases. So we're talking about livestock in other countries. Why should people in the United States care about what's happening to livestock in other countries?
So when we think about how people move about the globe these days and the risks to the United States food supply of a foreign animal disease getting here, that is the reason that we need to be concerned. We have had outbreaks of foot and mouth disease. The latest outbreak was in the 1920s, and we don't want to have that ever again. If one case of foot and mouth was discovered in the United States, that would pretty much shut down export of all beef products. Commerce for beef in this country would stop until we could get that under control. And same with classical swine fever or African swine fever. And African swine fever is in the Caribbean currently, so it's not that far away. And USDA actually has labs there and is doing a lot of surveillance to make sure that it stays there. Part of the risk is not animals themselves coming into this country. They're not going to get on a plane, you know, and come over and infect us. But it's the movement of food items where some of these viruses can live for extended period of time. It's people and things that they bring with them into the country. So control at the borders and surveillance there is very important as well for making sure that these diseases stay out of the United States.
So I'm assuming that farmers and veterinarians are trained to recognize these diseases. And is Plum Island involved in training people to do that?
Oh, absolutely. That is another big mission at Plum Island. They have Foreign Animal Disease Diagnostician School, a course for veterinarians within the United States, you know, first responder type folks who would go out if there was an outbreak, state veterinarians, et cetera, go to Plum Island physically. And since that's the only place in the United States where they can experience and see those diseases, which look a lot like others out in the field. So it's very important that they get proper training on how to take the diagnostic samples, what exactly they're looking for, and get a good look at these diseases firsthand to better protect our food supply.
I looked up these three diseases, foot and mouth disease, classical swine fever, and African swine fever, which are currently studied at Plum Island, just to kind of get an idea of, you know, how nasty they are and how vulnerable we would be as far as our food safety, public safety, and the economy, right? So foot and mouth disease alone, it's viral and it affects all cloven-hoofed animals. It's considered to be one of the most contagious infectious diseases known, and cost estimates of an introduction of foot and mouth disease to the United States are over $37 billion. All right, so we're talking about diseases that could cripple the economy, right? And classical swine fever just affects pigs, but we know it's widespread throughout the world, and it has the potential to cause a devastating epidemic, especially in countries that don't have the disease like the United States. Any outbreak of classical swine fever would also have serious consequences for domestic and international trade.
Yes, and I think it's important to mention that these three very important diseases actually don't affect humans. And it's important to mention that foot-and-mouth disease is not necessarily fatal to those animals. The reason it's called foot and mouth disease is the animals get blisters that are on their tongues and their mouths, and they can't eat for a while. So they do suffer. And even if they get over it, they would never be the same. And African swine fever is actually very deadly, as well as classical swine fever. Should an outbreak occur of any of these diseases, part of that response would be mass euthanasia.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But there's something else that's interesting here about African swine fever that ties into the last episode that we did on Get Real, where we talked about the animal rights supported importation of dogs from other countries into the United States. And it turns out that dogs can carry African swine fever. They don't get sick from it, but they carry it and they can spread it around. And they also can carry it on their fur and in their bedding, right? So this is another situation where we've got to look at the animals that are coming across our borders and be really, really careful about it, because here we are spending all of this time and effort and decades of research trying to recognize, prevent, and hopefully at some point stop this horrible disease that could cripple our economy. And we have dogs just coming in over the border, in many cases illegally, because proper procedures aren't being followed or the animals aren't being properly vetted. So, I mean, it just, like you said, right, it's a small world. Everything is so fluid now. I think that kind of ramps up the concern about all of these diseases, right? So now Plum Island is aging out. You can go as far as a BSL-3 level pathogen and study things there. But now that's not enough. The world has become a bit more dangerous and we need to step up our game, right? And I'm assuming then that that's where this new facility, the USDA National Bio and Agro Defense Facility, comes in. And this one is not on an island. Tell us a little bit about this new facility and how it's different from the Plum Island facility, and what the big advantages are, and what's so amazing about this new facility that you have the pleasure of being the attending veterinarian for.
Yeah, great question. I love talking about this because the whole process of what we've gone through is really pretty cool. When the powers that be had the vision that Plum Island needed to be replaced, things have come a long way as far as engineering controls and ways to handle pathogens. The technology was not there when Plum Island was built. That's how we're able to have kind of an expanded capability, but also that's how we're able to put this in the middle of the Midwest, because we are not an island. We're in Kansas. So I get that question a lot. How can this be put in the middle of Kansas? And the answer is that we have the modern engineering and technology now that we can build a building like this and know that we are doing everything really safely with the pathogens that we have here. The other piece of the vision was an expansion of what Plum Island could do. They wanted to be able to train more foreign animal disease diagnosticians because that's such a unique program. I don't think there's anything like that in the world. And our training necropsy is gorgeous and huge and can take more students per year and expand that program. They have an increased mission for a biologic developments module, which would fast track any science that looked promising for a vaccine into kind of micro production and then work with some partners around here to launch those vaccines more quickly. We are located in what they call the Kansas City Animal Health Corridor. We're kind of the most western edge of that. And there are a lot of biopharmaceutical companies from here through Missouri to collaborate with. We're also right next door to Kansas State University, and they have infectious disease capabilities and a lot of collaboration there. So there are a lot of advantages to being in this location. Then what's really exciting about MBAF is that currently, if there's a pathogen or a sample or something that goes to Plum Island that needs even higher containment than a BSL-3, currently that has to go outside of the country to be examined and dealt with and looked at. And here at MBAF, we have a BSL-4. So that is the type of space that is containment where you go in and you're going in what looks like a spacesuit. You have your own oxygen supply. You're never in contact with the pathogens. And we're the only facility in the history of the United States that has BSL-4 that can work with large livestock. So now we don't have to rely on the handful of other labs like this in the world to do that work for us. We have our own capability. And that has come up to public importance a little bit more with COVID. I'm not saying that was a BSL-4, but we know that up to 75% of emerging diseases are actually zoonotic, or can be transmitted from humans to animals, animals to humans. And the three diseases that we were looking at Plum Island are not zoonotic. So we're adding a zoonotic disease profile to NBAF as well.
If you're going to be studying BSL-4 level pathogens in the middle of Kansas, not on an island in the middle of the water someplace, you know, Kansas, everybody's seen The Wizard of Oz. You know, Kansas gets tornadoes. I mean, you know, all of us have to be concerned about natural disasters. How are you going to protect everybody in the event of a natural disaster like a tornado? How are you going to keep that place safe? I'm sure that was engineered into the design. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it absolutely was. I mean, that was a design question when Kansas was chosen as the location. That was definitely well thought out. We describe containment here as kind of a box within a box within a box. The most dangerous or high risk pathogens are in the middlemost of that box. And then there's another box around it. And then there's another box around it to try and keep things contained. Around all those boxes, we have this weather containment zone where there are really heavy steel doors that can shut in the event of a tornado. They can shut in a manual mode. So if we knew there was a tornado coming, the facilities would keep an eye on that, make some announcements, and then shut those doors. Or if there was just a sudden drop in air pressure, we have some sensors on the roof that would detect that, and then those doors would shut automatically. And that would contain all of the biocontainment areas that we have at NBAF and keep that totally sealed in the event of high wind hitting the building or a tornado. It's rated actually to have an EF5 tornado over the top of NBAF for up to 5 minutes. We feel exceptionally safe from tornadoes when we're inside that envelope.
I also saw something very interesting. High reliability organizations, or HROs, nuclear power plants would be an example of a place where containment is so important that there are these additional processes that are put into place. And then once all of those processes are put into place, that organization can be qualified as an HRO, a high reliability organization. My understanding is that you folks at NBAF are in the process of achieving that. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. And if you think about starting a lab like this in modern times, where we have a chance to all start together and build a culture, choosing to work towards a high reliability organization, and that's really what it is. It's not an engineering control, and it doesn't have to do with all of the safeguards that we have in place physically. This is really a cultural safety measure. So we train on these high reliability organization principles, and some of those are kind of like a see something, say something situation. There is absolutely no backlash for reporting a concern at NBAF, whether it's a little bit of ice on the sidewalk coming in the winter, or it's just something that doesn't appear right or look right or feel right, or something doesn't work properly, even if it seems super small. Another tenet of HRO is that if you're in a room with an entire team, from scientists to a technician to anybody that is working on a project, we don't always look towards the boss and let them make the decisions. HRO means that everybody's voice is important, and most often the person closest to the work, your animal care technician, for instance, should be the most trusted authority on certain situations. So I love that part of HRO. It kind of evens out the playing field, makes everybody have more of a feeling of trust with each other, because you're not going to have biosecurity, physical security, and a great facility without trusting each other. Working towards HRO has just been really kind of fun and interesting and really refreshing from a cultural standpoint in an institution.
Yeah, well, my understanding is that NBAF will be the first high containment lab facility to achieve HRO status. Is that correct?
Yes, that's my understanding as well. It seems like the HRO concept is starting to trickle into the science world a little bit, and I really hope it does spread around, because it makes coming to work really rewarding when you know that you can just speak up anytime, or that we're trying to consciously build trust in this kind of organization.
Yeah, well, I mean, in a place like this, it is really, really critical. I read something yesterday, like if one animal gets African swine fever and they have to shut everything down, that could cost the United States $50 billion. I mean, so it's like huge amounts of money. And of course, they all spread so rapidly. So it's really quite something to keep all of this in check. I think this HRO initiative is really something. And I was a little shocked to find out that this would be the first high containment laboratory with that status. So that has me concerned about all of the others. But you are going to study some nasty diseases here, right, that you're adding to the profile, some insect-borne diseases, because this goes back to the concern about emerging infectious diseases and the fact that the World Health Organization says that, you know, about 75% of them are spread from animal to people. And we have these lovely little vectors, these little insects that love to carry things between animals and people, or animals and animals and people and people. And some of them are quite awful. So maybe you can talk to us about some of these other diseases that you folks are going to study in your new arthropod section.
So there is a new arthropod-borne research unit. There had been one here in Manhattan, and NBAF kind of absorbed that unit. These are a great group of people. They're looking at Rift Valley fever and Japanese encephalitis virus. Both of these viruses are diseases of concern, and we're actually doing some of that work now because these are BSL-3. Though they're zoonotic, we're able to use the facilities at Kansas State University to do some of this work while NBAF gets up and running. So that's an exciting expansion. And then the scariest or the highest risk disease like Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever and the Nipah viruses, we haven't been able to really study those in the way that we will be able to at NBAF because of the size restrictions of the other laboratories around the world. So we've got a great space in the BSL-4, and that's where those will be studied. And we'll be able to look at adult animals versus smaller animals. I don't think they know exactly how those viruses are transmitted through milk or semen or things like that. So if we need to breed animals, we could do that as well. So there's some exciting opportunities to try and understand these diseases to really protect ourselves in the future, just with these expanded capabilities at NBAF.
Yeah, because these are things, you know, we just don't know, right? We're always playing catch up. These diseases come and then we're trying to figure out how are they spread? You know, how do we prevent them from spreading more? Can we treat them? And, you know, these are not nice diseases. I mean, just the name of that one, Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever. That sounds bad.
You're so right about that. We can finally look at some of these expanded diseases because we don't know what we might study in the BSL-4 here. We've never had one that can work with livestock of that size. And so if something new comes out, we don't have to pedal around and try and find another international lab. We can do it right here.
And there are four viruses. There's Rift Valley fever, Japanese encephalitis virus, the Crimean Congo hemorrhagic fever, which is my personal favorite because it sounds so horrible, and Nipah virus, right? I mean, the thing about it is these diseases can affect all of the agricultural animals as well as us. And so there's sort of a more intense concern relative to the other three, which were really more just about livestock and the economy. Now we're also talking about public safety in a much more direct way. So I think NBAF is going to be just an amazing facility. And, you know, most of us, we just don't think about these things, right? You know, we think about research with animals, and most people aren't thinking about this, right? You might be thinking about, you know, biomedical research. We talk about that all the time. And what's interesting is this is sort of an intersection between research with animals to maintain food production, but then also research with animals that are a part of food production that might harbor diseases that can affect human beings. It's just astounding how critical this work really is. And I mean, could you do any of this without the animals?
Whenever we ask ourselves, should we be doing this research, we take a look and make sure that there would be no way to do this same work without using animals. While we're using animals to answer these questions, we're also always thinking about how we can do this work without using animals. Cell culture, computer modeling, lots of different types of sequencing that are happening right now. I've seen some of these labs and talked to some of the PIs, and they are working towards some of those strategies. But for sure, the majority of this infectious disease work could not be done at all without using these livestock.
Yeah, and I love the alternative strategies. You know, at this point, none of the microphysiological systems, you know, the stem cell strategies that we hear about, none of them can fully replace an animal model, right? But they can go a long way toward fine-tuning our approach when we're studying things to reduce the number of animals necessary, and in some cases, improve the predictability of our findings, right, in terms of how that directly relates to people. And so I think it's really wonderful that you have folks there also integrating these non-animal strategies, because these are animals, and we love them. And these animals, you know, they're pretty heroic. They are the first line of defense for the rest of the world right now. And it's important to care about them a lot. And of course, that brings me to this great segue about you personally. I think it's really interesting that you're working in this cool place, BSL-4 containment and all of these diseases. And, you know, actually in a tornado, you and the pathogens would be safe inside. But I know you from Lab Animal. You're an ACLAM boarded laboratory animal veterinarian, and our paths have crossed for years at Lab Animal meetings. And you're a person who is a very accomplished veterinarian who just really, really, really loves animals and always has. And I know how important animal welfare is to you. Tell me what you're doing for the animals at MBAF.
Yeah, you know, I started here in 2020 and there was no program. I was the first employee for Animal Resources Unit, and I was kind of disoriented and, you know, having been in this industry for a while, looking around and okay, I get to start my own whole program. Anything I want to do, I can put in place. So, you know, kind of let's get started. And then COVID hit. So for those first 2 or 3 years while we were stuck at home, I had hired animal caretakers, other true animal lovers, really qualified folks. People came from Plum Island that used to work there to work with us. And I was able to hire this amazing, amazing team where everybody really gets it and really feels this way. And so that's different than walking into a facility where, you know, things have always been this way and on and on. The gift of being able to start a program from scratch is amazing. One of the first things we did was to work on SOPs and all of that stuff and all the regular items that you have to tick off for an animal program. But we started our enrichment program back then. So our enrichment program has been going since 2020, even though we haven't had animals yet in our facility. And what our team has designed was an entire book, science-based, not just like, oh, here's all the toys we want to give the animals, but a clear picture of each species that we plan to have or could have at MBAF, what their behavioral needs are, what would work for them, and then putting that against what is going to work for us within containment. So this has been something that's been going on for years, and they just recently showed me like their latest update because they keep making it better and better all the time. Very robust enrichment program. They're really excited about that. But to make sure that I really got it right with the animals that are coming into MBAF, we're also hiring a behaviorist as a postdoc to help us design some of our studies on things like cortisol, whether we bring them into the facility, how long do we have them in these specific rooms? What does this husbandry practice do to their activity or to their stress? So I'm given total support to work on all of that because they want NBEF's animal care program to be really world-class and to take all of those best principles that we've learned all over these years, that this is best practice, this is the way to do it. And I can start that with those best practices and then keep continuing on. There's not a whole lot of BSL-4 livestock containment information out there. So there's a lot of opportunity here to put some information out there into the field and say, you know, look, this is what works. This is what makes things better. This is what doesn't work. So we're really excited about all of that. We have a robust conditioning program as well, to where our plan is to receive animals a couple of weeks in advance and have our folks work with them with PPE in very similar penning and gating to what they'll have inside containment so that we can get the animals really used to what it's going to be like in there and reduce the stress of the change in environment. We're going to use positive reinforcement training, teach pigs to walk onto the scale to get their weights rather than, you know, try and wrestle anybody or hurt anybody that way. All these sorts of things hopefully will come together with some real science from this behaviorist, making sure that we're doing all the right things and tracking that. There's also a livestock behavioral research unit with USDA, and I've reached out to them, and within USDA, other researchers who are doing best practices for livestock out in the field. So we have access in the government to a lot of these minds, and that makes me so excited for the future of this program.
You get to set the standard for how animals are actually raised. I mean, this is important work, and we certainly don't need any confounds coming from stress that the animals might be experiencing because they don't have all of their behavioral needs met. So I'm not surprised. I expected as much from you, but this is phenomenal. And I look forward to all the papers you guys are going to write about how to do this work well, because it's critical work and that data has to be meaningful. I mean, this place sounds like it's got it all going on. It's very exciting. So you're not open. When do you expect the transition to be complete from Plum Island to NBEF?
That's a really great question. I think all of us would love to know that. The one part I can say to that is when it's safe to do so. So right now we're still checking things. There is science happening adjacent to what's going on right now, even though we're not open and 100% up. We are open and we are doing some very early phase science. So researchers are in their labs. They're allowed to use uninfected cell lines and things like that right now to check their machines and to make sure things are working. And so that's kind of the phase we're at. I hope to have animals within the next year. I could see that happening late spring next year, just a couple to make sure that everything's working for our husbandry SOPs and everything like that. And then the diagnostic lab, that's a pretty important piece because they can't shut down there until they're up and running here, because we can't not have a diagnostic lab. So that's going to be a very interesting transition. And we'll start slow here, starting to receive samples for certain pathogens that are low risk before they make sure they can transition fully. So it's a very complicated process. It's a very big deal to fully transfer. And I suspect it'll be years before we're ready to go 100%.
Well, it's amazing. And I'm so grateful to you and everybody else at NBAF and everybody listening to this who didn't know about this before, I'm sure is also grateful. We take our food safety for granted. And it's because of the folks who are doing this work that we can live a relatively carefree life. We don't worry because we have folks like you worrying all the time. So I'm super grateful for all the work you're doing. And, you know, on a personal level, I'm so proud of you and the work you're doing specifically in my case for the animals in this program. I love hearing all of that. And I think this is going to be an amazing facility and we're going to get a lot of very interesting science from it. And that's going to be good for the whole world. Before we close, I just want to offer you an opportunity to share any final thoughts you might have, anything you want to share with our listeners.
Yeah, you know, I really do want to say one more thing that makes this place amazing is that we have our own communications department. So if any listeners are worried or have concerns or just want to hear more about what was talked about today, you can go online and find the communications website for us. And there's real people answering those. I will say too that we've had the press tour through our animal rooms. This program is extremely transparent. You know, we're extremely secure, but we're not secret. We want people to know what's going on here because it's important for all of us. So we have a very strong link to the local community here with a community liaison group. And I can't tell you the feeling, Cindy, when I was standing in one of our animal rooms surrounded by press, I was just like, pinch me. Is this for real? Because we never get to do that. And I'm really grateful that we have such good support here to build a really, really good program and to not hide what we're doing. And we actually are really proud of the program that we're building. And I feel very lucky that I got to be the one here in Manhattan, Kansas, who got the job offer, because it's an amazing group of people here.
Very good. Thank you again so very much, Dr. Behnke, for your time today.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm such a fan, and I really appreciate the opportunity.
I don't know about you, but this was all news to me. I had no idea that this kind of intense biosurveillance of our livestock was even happening, let alone worldwide. But then I saw a blurb by a vegan group trivializing the inauguration of NBAF this past May. And in that blurb, the author says, and I quote, "Absent the animal ag industry, the $1.25 billion spent on this facility could have been spent on other important issues, like access to affordable health care." Okay, look, I understand that vegans are opposed to eating animals or anything derived from animals, and I have zero issue with anyone's dietary choice, truly. But only about 0.1% of the population worldwide are vegans. To the remaining 7.82 billion people in the world, the animals, the caregivers, and the researchers at NBAF are heroes. And I, for one, am thankful. Send me your thoughts on the matter at getrealpodcast.info, and I'll post them on our social media pages for discussion. And while you're there, please click on the support link. You know you want to do it. I know it, and you know it. Go click on the support link and commit to a small monthly donation. We still have a lot to talk about, and I appreciate your engagement. I'm Dr. Cindy Buckmaster, your host for Get Real. Thanks for joining us today. Up next, is compassion fatigue even a real thing? We'll explore this together on the next episode of Get Real. We'll talk soon.